From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The rise of Donald Trump has sent shockwaves through the American political landscape over the past couple of years. But his presidency is not an isolated phenomenon, at least globally. Across many countries, authoritarian leaders have exploited the grievances of resentful populations to grab power and roll back progress on many fronts. Over the last 2 years, there have been many books attempting to explain the rise of right-wing authoritarianism. One of the latest is an offering by the renowned writer Francis Fukuyama, who now joins me. Mr. Fukuyama is the Olivier Nomellini Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He's previously taught at the Paul H. Nitzsche School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins University and at the George Mason University School of Public Policy. He was a researcher at the RAND Corporation. He also served as the Deputy Director in the State Department's Policy Planning Staff. He's the author of the seminal book, The End of History, and The Last Man, as well as America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. He joins me to discuss his newest book called Identity, The Demand for Dignity and Politics of Resentment. Welcome to the program, Mr. Fukuyama.
Thank you very much.
So this book, you open your book saying that you couldn't have written it without the coming to power of Donald Trump. How did Trump's coming to power change everything? And for you, was it entirely unpredictable, or was this something that you saw coming?
Well, Donald Trump is not an isolated phenomenon, as your intro suggested. In the last few years, there's been the rise of a number of authoritarian populist leaders around the world. I would include Viktor Orban in Hungary, President Erdogan in Turkey. Vladimir Putin was an early version of this, the Law and Justice Party in Poland. And then you've got quite a number of anti-immigrant, anti-EU parties nipping at the heels. You know, the latest one was a coalition of populist parties that came to power in Italy just this past year. And so this is a big change. I think that democracies have been threatened by authoritarian powers like China or Russia, external powers in the past. But this is a different phenomena insofar as the threat is really legitimately elected leaders that then begin to dismantle the rule of law institutions, the constitutional order of their societies, and it's happened really in Britain under the Brexit vote and in the Trump vote, in the two countries that were the big pillars of the liberal international order for the past 50 years. And so that's a big phenomenon. That's a big shift in global politics, and that's something that I wanted to understand better.
Now, some have pointed out that this is a function of the weaknesses of our democracy itself, of our democratic systems and the way they're designed and how they've been exploited, even going as far as laying the blame on the feet of social media. But really, isn't the underlying phenomenon that we really need to grapple with the economic malaise, the financial distress that we've seen rising from wealth inequality over several decades?
So that, I think, is basically right. However, with a certain caveat at the end. So I do think the trigger for this has really been, as you say, the inequality that's been produced by globalization. We've, especially since the rise of Reagan and Thatcher in the 1980s, lived in an increasingly interdependent world where trade, goods, investment, people, ideas have moved across international borders. And that has actually created a tremendous amount of wealth. Global output since 1970 has quadrupled, more than quadrupled. And in places like China, India, Bangladesh, and so forth, lots of people have been lifted out of poverty. They've joined the middle class. And so, you know, there's a very good side to everything that's happened. But what's happened in the rich world is that a lot of jobs, particularly for less educated, less skilled workers, have migrated to Asia, to other parts of the developing world, and there's been a lot of downward mobility for people that formerly thought of themselves as middle class. And so that's reflected in these inequality statistics where, you know, more than half of Americans are earning either as much or even less money than they were in the year 2000. So 18 years have passed, and you know, for a very large group of Americans, they've seen no economic progress at all. So that's the part where I think inequality really has triggered this. The part that I think requires a further explanation is why this has been interpreted and benefited parties of the right rather than parties of the left. Normally, if you have a financial crisis like the one we suffered in 2008, where a bunch of big investment banks, you know, screw up and it causes a collapse that sends, you know, millions of people out of their houses, raises the unemployment rate, you know, impoverishes ordinary people, you would think that this would then trigger a left-wing upsurge. But instead, what we got in the United States was the Tea Party. And in Europe, you know, a lot of the traditional left parties, the Social Democrats in Germany, the Socialists in France, various communist parties, all have been losing votes, and they've been losing votes to right-wing nationalist parties. And so that's what needs explaining, is why economic inequality has actually benefited the right rather than the left. And that's where I think this issue of identity comes in, because those right-wing parties have been able to frame the problem in these identity terms rather than in the, you know, the classic ways that the left has framed it.
So are you suggesting that a lack of class consciousness and or class solidarity has, you know, given way to people identifying in ways that pit them against one another?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, this is not a new phenomenon. You know, the social anthropologist Ernest Gellner had this kind of amusing metaphor for what was going on. He said there was a letter that had been addressed by the Marxists to class, and instead it got delivered to an address called Nation. And this happened, you know, back in 1914. The Second International, Socialist International, thought that workers would unite around working class issues, and instead they all lined up behind Germany, Britain, France, you know, nations. And I think something similar is happening right now, that there's a class distress, but it is being interpreted, you know, the loss of a job, the loss of income is being interpreted not in, you know, these broad terms, but rather these are foreigners, they're coming to take our jobs, they're stealing our national identity. That's really the problem. And I think that's why these right-wing parties have been doing as well as they have.
Earlier, you said that there had been a opening up of trade, et cetera, free movement across borders. But really, there hasn't been much free movement across borders of people, has there? I mean, there has been movement, but it hasn't been free. It's been forced. There's been forced displacement. Populations haven't necessarily been welcomed in. It's been patchy. Some countries have been more welcoming than others. Trade was allowed to flow. Labor was not allowed to flow. We saw a tremendous rise of poverty in some countries that became manufacturing hubs for wealthier nations. We saw wars waged by countries like the US and countries in Europe that also led to forced displacement. So aren't the liberal democracies in many ways guilty of fomenting some of these pressures that have led to people leaving their own nations, that have led to a rise of this backlash and authoritarian leaderships?
Well, so first of all, I disagree with the empirical observation that there hasn't been a big movement of people. If you look at the numbers of foreign-born people in OECD countries, that is to say this club of, you know, 20-some-odd rich countries, there's been a remarkable change. So basically Western Europe now, you know, countries, Switzerland actually tops the list. Something like 27% of its current population was born outside of Switzerland. In the United States, the figure is like 14, 15%. But, you know, France, the Netherlands, Germany, Scandinavia, all of these countries have seen really massive increases in foreign-born people, and this is something they've not experienced except, you know, over the past generation. Australia, Canada both have around over 20% of their populations born outside, so there's been a tremendous movement. The other thing that I would disagree with is that this is all being driven somehow by the foreign policies of these, you know, these rich countries. You take something like this, the Syrian civil war that was responsible for this massive wave of, you know, a couple million people trying to move to Europe. I mean, the West may have been responsible for it by inaction, you know, by not intervening earlier to unseat Bashar Assad. But basically, this was a thing that was driven by this out of control identity politics in Syria itself. And so there's a lot of causes, you know, I mean,
that doesn't hold true for Iraq and Afghanistan, though, from where a lot of migrants and refugees have fled. And those wars in particular were directly driven by the West, by NATO in Afghanistan, at least.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, again, a complicated one because, you know, there was a big terrorist operation operating there before 2001 and misruled by the Taliban. So people, you know, that civil war has really been going on since 1978. And so it's true that the United States did not solve that problem by intervening. But I think that the sources of migration out of Afghanistan way predate, that American intervention. So, yeah, I mean, look, we can, there's lots to complain about in terms of American foreign policy, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I think that, you know, the underlying problem is that there are a lot of people that are living in very unstable, unhappy countries that are not growing economically, that are not offering opportunities. And that's creating a substantial pressure to migrate. By the way, you know, just another little empirical fact, if you think that people are not leaving, if you look within the European Union under the Schengen plan, you know, that permits free movement of people within the Schengen zone. Not only has that led to these massive increases in foreign-born people living in the receiving countries like Britain and Germany and France and so forth, it's basically depopulated Eastern Europe. So Ukraine, many of the Balkan countries, you know, Poland itself have seen drops in their population of 20-30% of, you know, what they had 10 or 15 years ago. So between Poland and Britain, something like 900,000 Poles moved to Britain in a two-year period. Britain's got a population of about 60 million, so you add another 900,000 Poles in 2 years. I mean, that's an extraordinary degree of movement of people. So there's something going on in the world that is related to the openness, the fundamental openness of this liberal international order, and that in turn, I think, is what's provoked this backlash. Because,
but don't people move to look for better opportunities? I mean, most people leave behind their birth countries or the countries of their birth because they can't necessarily make it, you know, where they live. A tremendous amount of migration is a result of pressure. And certainly it does help that there might be countries where immigration policies allow them to move. I want to go back to what you were saying on the issue of globalization really leading to the current state that we are in. Didn't critics of globalization predict that we would see rising inequality, which in turn is a driver of immigration, mass immigration?
Well, again, that's a little bit complicated. I think that the way that economies have developed over the past generation has actually gone contrary to a lot of the existing economic models. So there was something of a Kuznets phenomenon associated with this, you know, the economist Simon Kuznets, that said, yes, it's not just globalization, but it's economic growth, that as a country is modernizing, as it's growing economically, it does lead to an increase in inequality. And then that in the past has then you know, when you reach a certain level of income, the inequality then starts to decrease. That was the experience of Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries. That was the case of the United States and so forth. That's not been the case of countries that have grown very rapidly in recent years, where inequality has continued to increase. And that may have to do with some of the specific features of the nature of globalization, that capital is very mobile right now. It's very easy to shelter your income. You know, rich people can hide from tax authorities, and you know, I mean, so there's reasons like that that are connected with the specific nature of globalization. But the other thing about migration is that people do not migrate from the absolutely poorest countries in the world. They actually tend to immigrate from countries that are modernizing, they're growing, but the expectations for better lives exceeds the actual capacity of the country to deliver. So, for example, there was a huge increase in migration from Korea just at the moment that Korea was industrializing. A lot of Koreans came to the United States at that point when their country actually, you know, looking back, was really doing great. But that really had to do with expectations rather than, you know, absolute poverty. I mean, people that are living in abject poverty usually don't have the resources to, you know, to attempt the kind of migration, the risks that are associated with migration mm-hmm. these days. There is a lot of forced migration. So what's happened with the Rohingya in Myanmar is a complete scandal. I mean, it's a form of ethnic cleansing. You know, the Burmese don't want this population there. And so they've been forcibly driving out millions of people. So that, you know, that is a phenomenon in many parts of the world.
So we have a situation now where there are mixed populations, if you will, in many countries. Leaders like Donald Trump exploit that fear of the foreigner in order to retain power, in order to push regressive policies. What do you call for in your book is a way in which to counteract this. We talked earlier briefly about the need for class solidarity and for a strong class consciousness among working people, among people who are struggling, that transcends some of these differences. Can you explore that a little bit?
Well, I think that you need class solidarity. You also need cross-class solidarity. So if you think about the United States right now, I think that the single biggest weakness that we have in our political and social system is the degree of polarization that exists in the country. You know, you've got a red America and you've got a blue America. Because they have electorally been fairly evenly matched, it means that Congress has been paralyzed, you know, from acting on a whole bunch of issues. So, you know, it's not possible to get gun control. It's not possible to enact a universal healthcare system. It's not possible to do comprehensive immigration reform. All of these things, I think, are, you know, in a sense, desired by quite a lot of Americans. But because of the polarization, the system is stuck. And so I think that, yes, you need class solidarity. You also need cross-class solidarity. And I think that actually depends on widening the scope of identity to emphasize things that are more integrative, that emphasize things that Americans hold in common. And that's really the only way that you're going to get across this fundamental polarization. If you only focus on the solidarity of one side or the other, that's ultimately not going to get you where you have to go, because in the end, the kinds of policies that will be necessary to substantively address inequality require a higher degree of consensus. You got to pass, legislation through Congress. If you're going to have social protections, if you're going to defend, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you've got to persuade people, you know, to pay the money. You've got to persuade skeptical legislators. That's the way you work things out in a democratic political system. And so I think that's the kind of political task that's in front of us.
Don't you think that it's healthy to have a certain resentment against the very wealthiest in the nation? I'm thinking of the Occupy Wall Street protests, where people really characterize themselves as the 99% versus the 1%. I mean, 99% is pretty broad, covers a majority, vast majority of Americans, and indeed the rising inequality within the United States is, in many ways driven by secretive billionaires who have their hands in our political system. And so it's hard to think about cross-class solidarity with the very richest.
Yeah, that's not the kind of cross-class solidarity I was thinking of. So yeah, obviously you can't do anything unless you mobilize people politically. And people are always mobilized by resentment, by anger, by, resentment at injustice, of various sorts. So I think that's completely correct. But if you think about, for example, let's say that you are a progressive politician, you're a Democrat, and you want to, defend healthcare, you want to get something like Medicare for all. The question that is then facing you is, how do you actually persuade enough Americans to vote for members of Congress that will actually support the kind of legislation that's necessary to get you there? And the real question, that I think actively faces the Democratic Party is whether they appeal to their traditional identity groups, which means African Americans, Hispanics, women, the LGBT community, or do they try to win back some of the white working class voters that used to constitute actually the largest group, single interest group within the Democratic coalition from the New Deal on? Do you try to win some of those white working class voters back? And frankly, that's what delivered the election to Donald Trump. I mean, if Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin had not narrowly gone for him, he would not be president today. And so when I talk about cross-class solidarity, I think that's really the issue. It's not, are you going to persuade billionaires to give up their billions. I think it's really, are you going to persuade a majority of American voters to vote for politicians that will then support, whatever is needed, higher taxes or, broad-based social programs? I think that's really the practical political issue.
Now, there's some indication that plenty of well-educated whites also voted for Trump, not necessarily just the working class whites. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, because that seems to be a pressure, or that seems to be a force driven by the politics of racial resentment. And then back to your earlier point about having politicians that can really express policies that will benefit all Americans. We are seeing a new class of, in particular, newly elected members of Congress, many of them people of color, many of them women and women of color, that are expressing very strong working class solidarity and support for issues like Medicare for all Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, so I think that, the policy, we can argue about the exact form that it takes, but again, the question is, how do you build support for that? And I think that it requires, reaching out beyond, the circle of progressive, politicians who, especially in swing states, are never going to constitute a majority of voters. And how do you, get enough people on board behind that? I think that that's really, it's a doable task. It requires a certain amount of leadership. And I think that it also, well, I don't know, there's also an agenda, I think, of political reform, because I think there are aspects of our political system that make it much easier for a determined minority of people to block things that they don't like. I think that's the case with gun control, for example. So if you look at poll data, vast majority of Americans prefer, some form of background checks and kind of relatively modest things to control the flow of guns in our society. You've got this nucleus of, 20-30% of Americans who are absolutely opposed to any form of gun control at all. And because of the way our system privileges minority, you know, well-organized minorities, you've simply not been able to get to, you know, a sensible policy on this. And so there's also an issue of how do you, you know, tweak the institutional rules of the system to make that sort of thing more possible.
And then finally, I'm wondering what your opinion is of what we're seeing playing out in France right now with the yellow vests. I mean, there's one school of thought that suggests when you're pushed far enough, opt for absolute and, you know, militancy at all costs. You know, there's been some argument that, well, using violence and ends up backfiring. Others point out that actually it can get what you want if you're strong enough, if you dig your heels in long enough, if you literally refused to back down, you may get what you want. And of course, the French have a long tradition of militant protest going all the way back to the French Revolution.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at the history of France since the French Revolution, that tradition is not, it's not that great. I mean, it has not led to a very stable democracy compared to other traditions, you know, in which that revolutionary impulse was not so deeply, deeply ingrained. No, I think that it is true that when democratic societies edge towards violence, people get scared. It can have one of two effects. It can actually bolster the forces of authority and reaction, saying, you know, look at what, you know, look at what the other side is producing. We need order and authority. Or it can scare them into saying, look, we really need to open up the system and accommodate some of those demands. And hopefully that's what's going to happen. I think the problem with the, you know, with the yellow vest movement is that it's kind of leaderless right now. And it's really not clear what these people want or represent, other than that they don't want this gas tax, you know, but you can't build an enduring political movement around, you know, an issue that's that narrow. And I suspect that it's kind of a leaderless coalition that wants a lot of things. I mean, I think that was the, you know, that was the problem with the Occupy movement. It was driven by a lot of righteous anger that was well justified in many cases, but because it was leaderless, it didn't have a clear agenda. And then it never went on to the next stage, which was to actually elect people that would implement whatever that agenda was. That's something that the Tea Party, you know, which was the other big populist movement at that time, that they understood, and they went on to elect a Republican Congress in, you know, in 2010. We'll have to see what happens with the Yellow Jackets. I'm actually not all that confident that they're going to be able to make the, you know, the move to the next stage to actually turn a social protest movement into a kind of enduring political mobilization that will then, you know, shift the nature of French politics.
Well, on that note, it seems as though there are some broader demands, because after Emmanuel Macron backed off, or at least postponed the fuel tax increase, a lot of the activists seem to say, well, you know, we want higher minimum wages. We want, you know, they did have some broader set of demands that they did release, and it remains to be seen certainly where that goes. And some have even argued, by the way, that the Tea Party was much less a grassroots political phenomenon than it was a sort of astroturf phenomenon funded by the billionaire Koch brothers and their ilk. And certainly the policies that came out of many of the Tea Party demands have benefited the wealthiest Americans.
Well, that all may be true. I mean, there was, you know, money can't buy everything in the United States, however. And so you had to have people that were willing to respond positively, voters that were willing to respond positively.
Sure.
But it's true, it was manipulated. It was manipulated by rich people. The main point, though, is that in a democracy, you can't get what you want just by protest and this kind of mobilization, this initial mobilization by itself, because you do have to work through institutions. You know, this was the Gramsci argument about the slow march through institutions, meaning that you have to gain political power. And in a democracy, you know, there are rules for how you do this in terms of voting and parties and, you know, enacting legislation and that sort of thing. And so that's, I think, for the you know, for the progressive left as a whole, that's really the agenda, is figuring out how to do that in a way that really is going to lead to enduring political power.
And it certainly remains to be seen how the 2020 elections shape up, to answer that question. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, and really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Francis Fukuyama, Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. His earlier books include The End of History and The Last Man and America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. We've been discussing his latest book, Identity, The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.